Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guest is the former acting, we're not going to ask how long, United States Secretary of State, Ambassador Frank Wisner. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. In other exciting news, the documentary Carville, Winning is Everything, Stupid, is now streaming on Max. Get updates and great behind-the-scenes content by following James on Twitter, @JamesCarville, and on his new TikTok, @RealJamesCarville. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Now tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Quince, Miracle Made, and The Washington Post. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. James, as we enter week three of the Trump revenge tour, the appointments continue to be like that infamous waterway in Louisiana, the one with no bottom. Education Secretary-designate Linda McMahon from the scandal-plagued World Wrestling Federation is the new Education Secretary. We may want to bring back Betsy DeVos. Then Dr. Oz. You know, Dr. Oz was once a credible surgeon who turned into a huckster, peddling phony cures on TV. He's going to head Medicare and Medicaid. I'm on Medicare, James. I don't feel assured. Trump 2.0 is breaking new records for corruption even before they take office. They're stiffing some of the ethics requirements. They're not having their appointees be vetted by the FBI. But dominant, I think, still are the final four of disgraceful appointments. Matt Gaetz, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Pete Hegseth, and Tulsi Gabbard. And in normal times, often happens when an administration comes in, the Congress picks that one that they're just going to knock down. They did it with Tom Daschle on a really minor thing with Obama. So the natural one here is Matt Gaetz, who is the sleaziest appointment maybe of all times. The House Ethics Committee stuff is damning. I am told there are other investigative bodies that have stuff that's even worse on this guy. So my guess is he'll go. But that would leave Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who claims vaccines cause autism and the COVID-19 engineered to target whites and blacks and protect Jews and Asians. You can't make that up. Tulsi Gabbard, a Putin-loving former Democrat, to lead the National Intelligence Agency. That was the one in Trump 1.0 that was headed by the highly qualified Dan Coats, who came away thinking Trump was compromised by Russia. No such danger with Tulsi. And finally, Pete Hegseth, the Fox News anchor, with no experience to run an $850 billion Defense Department. You know, he said that Charles Brown, the head of the Joint Chiefs, had to go. And he said he was picked because he was black. First of all, he was named Air Force Secretary by Donald Trump. Secondly, by making that kind of outrageous comment, what it shows us is, in addition to his other shortcomings, Hegseth is a racist. James, and I think the election was legitimate, but if a normal new president is elected, he should be able to choose his own people. But these choices are, to coin a phrase, so deplorable that all four, at a minimum, should be rejected.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that the way it always done is you kind of pick one, the most egregious one. And but you cannot fight by old rules because he's not sticking to the old script. And I'll repeat myself endlessly. The Democrats are an opposition party. They're not a minor governing party. That requires something entirely different than anything that we've ever done before. And, hopefully over the course of the next month that people come up with some kind of a strategy. But right now, people don't have one. We don't have one. They don't have one. But the one thing I know, we can't deal with this like we've dealt with things in the past. I mean, Trump doesn't play by any norms or conventions, tradition, anything that we're accustomed to. And we tend to want to fight under the rules of the Bush administration, which are completely inoperative for the current administration. And I don't know what's going to work. I know what has worked in the past or semi-worked in the past is not going to work here. And he has no intention of following any norms or anything else. And frankly, we're still trying to catch up to what's going on. But he's moving very fast. He wants to, the Washington Post had the most incredible story today. He wants to wreck the United States government. I mean, I've heard of people having a different view of the way the United States government ought to operate, or what its priorities should be, or what its direction should be, or what it should emphasize and not emphasize. It's kind of new to find somebody who wants to wreck the whole thing, but that's where we are. And that's where public opinion is in this country. Well, the best way it was on Election Day anyway. And this is a, so far, predictably, hopefully it doesn't continue, a feeble, confused opposition.
It is. And James, here's what worries me. We've talked about this before. Trump 2.0 is infinitely more dangerous and more ready to do awful things than was Trump 1.0. They didn't really know what they were doing. And the opposition, the resistance, whatever one wants to call it, is less prepared. The peril is greater, the danger is greater, and I'm afraid the counter is not as good. People are depressed, people are down. I mean, I think you have to set up a new structure. Maybe you don't, but you have to build on what you have. But it's really depressing because I think that gap between what's necessary and what exists today is a threat to the country.
Yeah, I don't know. The opposition, in a parliamentary system, the opposition is clean. It's clear. That's the non-ruling party in parliament. You know, so you have prime minister's questions. You have, you know, you have a shadow cabinet. You have all kinds of things like that. Our system is not equipped or hasn't in the past been equipped. I don't know who the Senate opposition is. Is it the House Democrats, the Senate Democrats? Is it the DNC? Are it the 22 or 23 or whatever number of Democratic governors we have? I don't know. But at some point, we are just going to have to figure this out and mount an opposition. And right now,
yeah,
we don't
I think
have
it's
that.
All the above, plus you need an awful lot more. That plus more.
Well, you see, but Albert, my point is, all of the above is nothing.
Right.
It has
That's
to
what
be,
I'm saying. You
there
need
has to
more,
be
absolutely.
A central.
And yeah. They have to be sharper. But, and frankly, you know, and every now and then, you need Republicans to do the right thing. Can't count on that most of the time. But there's a fight now. Trump says, I want to be able to make recess appointments of all my cabinet members. That flies in the face of history. It flies in the face of the Constitution. Flies in the face of the Federalist Papers also. And that means that what he'll do is he'll wait to, if the Senate goes out for a week, he'll name any sleazeball that he wants to. It totally, total abdication would vitiate the advising consent role. I think they won't get away with that. I know it's always a mistake to count on Republicans these days, but I think that's just a step too far. What they probably will do is what Tom Tillis in North Carolina said. Well, we won't do that for the cabinet post, but, you know, that's fine on all the sub-cabinets. Well, okay, but that'll clear the pathway for more, I guarantee you, than a handful of white nationalists and neo-Nazis who are going to populate this administration. And I just hope somehow we get ready for it. I don't have faith in Tom Tillis.
I don't think they give a shit what Tom Tillis thinks, and I think they're going to run over him. And I just think that there has to be a point person, a point people a point organization on the point of disopposition. And boy, in a party that's traditionally been disorganized, traditionally a party of coalitions and different interest groups, I don't think the Democrats are very prepared to fight this. I don't know, but they are going to try to run everything. And what they do have, undeniably, is for now, they have the authority of an election. And people kind of knew this and voted for him anyway. I'm going to go unring that bell, but it's a really profoundly serious time in American history with a confused, dazed opposition. And even in their own party, you know, to the extent that, well, you know, maybe somebody will come riding to the rescue. Boy, it doesn't seem like it. Something's going to happen. I don't know what it is, but something's going to happen that's going to ignite something. And I'm just not good enough at predicting the future to tell you what that's going to be. But it's beyond
it is. And that's why that recess, I don't have faith in Tom Tillis or, frankly, almost any other Republican now. That recess appointment is a matter of whether you believe in the Constitution and the prerogative of the Senate. It only takes three or four Republicans to say, no, we're not going to change 200 years of history. We'll see how that plays out. The other thing is that, let me give you an example. We talked about Getz a lot. RFK Jr., he has to be approved by the Health Committee. Now, on the Health Committee includes Bill Cassidy, who I think is an honest conservative from your state of Louisiana, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. Collins has often buckled. I'm not sure he can get through that. Now, Trump can say, fine, I'm going to appoint him anyway, which I think he would do. But that's I think they're going to have more challenges than they think. They may just run roughshod over them. They don't care about the rule of law. But let me go back to one more, and I want to get your view on this, James. Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary designate. Here was Pete's story last week. Now, just tell me, give me a rating on this. 7 years ago, he said he attended a conservative conference in California, had too much to drink. Also attending there was a woman whose husband and children were in a separate floor. She walked him back to his room, and he suggests she then sexually assaulted him. The woman, however, said she was the victim of a sexual assault. Hegseth paid her off. Hegseth, rather, paid her off to keep quiet because he said it would have hurt his career at Fox News if she had made what he says was this phony charge. On a scale of 1 to 100, James, 1 being you believe a story, 10 being it is just unbelievably a lie. How would you rate this version?
So the only way to rate it is in comparison. So that certain people stand out. Pete Hegseth is certainly a standout in a really, really important appointment for the President of the United States Secretary of Defense. Second in chain of command. Understand, every person, every private, every E1 has to memorize the chain of command. The last person before the President is the Secretary of Defense. So that's the chain of command that exists in the United States. So number one is Donald Trump. Number two is Pete Hegseth. That's awful. But compared to Matt Gaetz, I don't know. Compared to Bobby Kennedy, I don't know. Compared to Tulsi Gabbard, I don't know. What of the four, which person is the most loathsome that you can imagine? You could have a debate. I mean, Hegseth, but he would be certainly maybe until now the most loathsome cabinet appointee ever. But he doesn't have the clear. He's not the clear winner in the top tier of these appointments. And these are, I think maybe Tulsi Gabbard is the director of national intelligence might be the kind of worst. But I don't know. Is it worse than Bobby Kennedy? Is it worse?
Tough
I don't
call.
Know. And I don't know if anybody right. else does.
It's a tough call.
The problem is it's so, remember when John Ashcroft and people going crazy about John Ashcroft being attorney general. As it turned out, he had a guy who had some backbone. We don't have any historical reference for this. There's nothing that we can go back and point to. I don't know if we know how to cover it. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if the Times knows how to do this. The opposition is dazed, confused. You see a lot of, not going to criticize, but, you know, Joe and Mika going to Mar-a-Lago. I don't know what's going to happen to MSNBC. You see stuff, maybe they're going to spin it off. I don't know. The Post couldn't endorse Harris because Bezos. I mean, one of the things that you have that's happened with a lot of media is Comcast owns a lot of things. Jeff Bezos owns a lot of things. These entities are not independent. They have shareholders that they have to be accountable to. What's the number one job of a corporation? But, you know, Milton Friedman said, and I don't know that if even our friend Roger Altman would disagree, is to deliver value to its shareholders. Well, if you're trying to deliver value to its shareholders, it behooves you to somehow or another be an accommodationist. But think of how many media entities are owned by companies or people that have other interests. That's a large part of the problem. Can ProPublica, no one knows the fuck, they're great. I like ProPublica, don't get me wrong. But nobody knows who they are. And as Michael Tomansky pointed out, they literally control 80% of the media flow. And there has to be an opposition. I just don't know where it's centered and how it fights this.
Well, first of all, I make distinctions. I don't consider, Joe Scarborough is an entertainer. He was a big Trump person in 2016. MSNBC decided to go anti-Trump. He went that way. Now he's trying to crawl back. That doesn't really faze me much. I think his influence is enormously exaggerated. I think the Post, whoever owns the Post, I still have confidence. Maybe I'll be disillusioned. The Times. Will it make a difference? I don't know that. I don't think that the really good press, of which there are fewer than there used to be, is going to cave and be part of the Trump, Trump go-alongs. But boy, the task is so much bigger than just simply what a couple really good investigative reporters can do.
Scarborough has influence.
He was watched by the Biden camp and Democrats. It was a small. The numbers were small. They paled next to Fox and Company,
I understand. In my world, that show has influence,
but it's a small world.
I love the Post. I got it right in front of me. They're owned by Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos owes the shareholders of Amazon a lot. The federal government, in terms of how they deliver things, standards, postal rates, you name it, it's all conflicted. It's all conflicted. This is not some, weekly newspaper in Western Kansas, that's a muckraker fighting or something like that. The interactions, NBC News, which is, I love NBC News. I love MSNBC all the time. They got all kinds of cross pressures. ABC is owned by Disney. You know how much, look at what Disney had to go through in Florida with Ron DeSantis. That Bob Iger has responsibilities to shareholders. All of this cross-ownership has really compromised what people can do. And I understand that. I'm not being critical of Bob Iger. I'm not being critical of Comcast. You have conflicting obligations. That's what the media is today. That's just what it is. It's taken over by people with other business that are inherently dependent on the United States government to help them, at least not try to kill them.
I think that's true. Yeah, I will say that Bezos has owned the Post for, I don't know, 7 years. It's been as good as ever. Maybe it changes. I didn't like his non-endorsement. I worry a lot more about the coverage. I see no indications yet. Maybe there will be. The Times isn't really beholden much to the federal government. So, you know, I don't think it's totally lost there. MSNBC will just have to figure out what its niche is this time. But I would be very surprised if the Washington Post isn't as vigilant as ever. But, you know, we'll see. Let me give you one bit of good news, James. We need good news, right? I just looked this morning at the latest House results. It is conceivable that at the very end that it'll be 220 Republicans and 215 Democrats, more likely to be 221. Whatever it is, the Republicans didn't add to their majority, and Mike Johnson can ill afford, I mean, frankly, in the first couple months of the year with three cabinet members being selected and Matt Gaetz saying he's not going to take his place in Florida, he could end up having a 217 to 215 margin, which means he can't afford to lose a single vote. So they're lemmings, and maybe they'll all be lemmings. But boy, I'll tell you, it's going to be tough there. And of course, Mike Johnson takes his orders from Donald Trump.
I mean, Mike Johnson said my favorite of all time.
The Democrats did better than we thought election night.
Well, look, if we would have carried where we won Senate seats, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, Arizona, we'd have probably bust a number. Okay? But Mike Johnson, first of all, he is a man of extremely limited talent. He's a man of a huge position with extremely limited power. All right, you couldn't design a mishmash. And of course, because he doesn't know anything, he says, well, we would open Pandora's box. He has no fucking idea what Pandora's box means
Matt Gaetz, right.
I don't know if James G. Blaine of Maine, or I don't know, or Nancy Pelosi or Sam Rabin could survive this. And presumably, I know in the case of Pelosi, these are some of the most extraordinary, talented people that have ever been in modern American politics. Mike Johnson might be one of the, like, lowest in terms of ability or anything in all of history of American politics. And, you know, I don't know, but it's going to be something to watch. And as you have pointed out any number of times, it takes nine to call for a scalp. He's totally caught betwixt and between. I don't know. It's, Slotkin, Tammy Baldwin, Jackie Rosen, Ruben Gallego. I mean, these people did win. I mean, Bobby barely lost. I just keep going back to it. We just couldn't have been dumber this election year than we were. We just didn't. We knew we were making a mistake. Everybody knew it, and we couldn't do anything about it. It's like you're watching, you know, a friend, like, drink himself to death, and you say, shit, I can't do anything about it. You know, then you show up at the funeral and say, maybe we should have said something.
But it's a good analogy. All right, there is a little bit of good news. Now, I don't know, those House races, there's two California seats that are still too close to call. Democrats are up in one. Republicans are up in the other. If, they win both, they'll be up to 215 seats, which is not as much as we expected a month ago, but better than people thought a week ago. Okay, we'll be back next week with a little bit more cheery news, we hope.
No, we won't.
You're a fan of my podcast partner, Mr. Carville. I have a movie for you. James is the star of the fabulous, funny, and prophetic documentary called Carville, Winning is Everything, Stupid, directed by Matt Tiernauer. In it, you can see James warning the Democrats through the entire 2024 election cycle about the risk of losing the election to Donald Trump. And you can check the film streaming on Max now. The film also delves into James's marriage to Republican strategist Mary Madeline, offering an inside look at how they navigate their bipartisan life. If you're looking for an unfiltered take on the state of politics, the Carville-Madeline dynamic, and what Carville warned us would eventually cause the Democrats to lose this year, you definitely want to check out it by streaming on Max. How important is to get that message out, James?
Well, I don't know. I got to tell you, I know I'm the subject of it, but it's a very, very, very well-made movie. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But that movie, just by way of reference, is a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's pretty hard to accomplish in a country where you got a thousand different opinions about everything. So if you're 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, you're probably worth a look on Max.
Yeah, I would agree. And for updates and some great behind-the-scenes content, follow James on Twitter, at James Carville, and on his new TikTok, at Real James Carville. You won't want to miss it. Hey, James, our guest is Frank Wisner, longtime Foreign Service U.S. ambassador to four countries, including Egypt and India, top State Department official. He actually was Secretary of State for a matter of hours. Those were the high point of American diplomacy, the hours that Wisner ran the State Department. Most important, he is one of the wisest men I have ever known. Frank, you have served in Republican and Democratic administrations for decades. Look at the Trump 2.0 has already tapped its choices for state, defense, CIA, national intelligence. What's your assessment?
Well, I have to say I'm gobsmacked. Sorry to put it so bluntly, but I think you, Al, and James Carville, you're used to people being blunt. I believe our choice of Secretary of State is not a strong one. The NSC advisor and CIA look pretty solid to me, but the rest of the cabinet picks so far are really uninspiring, is about the nicest thing I can say about them. The head of national intelligence is clearly not up to the job, as I would have to say is true of Attorney General, Secretary of Defense. And now we're waiting for the Treasury pick, waiting for that without holding my breath. This is the least impressive cabinet, and it does two things. It sends a message to the country that the incoming president does not hasn't got a steady vision of the future of the United States, and it sends a signal to the world that we're adrift. So I am underwhelmed is about the nicest thing I can say.
You know, you've always valued strategic thinkers. I think you would say Kissinger was one, Brzezinski was one, probably our friend Richard Holbrooke, and I know you consider Jake Sullivan in that category. Are there any of these people, even the ones that are not as bad as the others, that are strategic thinkers?
I certainly don't know. I hear reasonable things about the NSC advisor. CIA pick looks reasonably promising, but strategic thinkers I don't see. People with long records of engaging with the world and world leaders, of thinking through the major issues of our day, I really don't see any of them in the present cabinet selection.
So much to cover. Ukraine. If Trump pressures Kyiv to take a deal that's favorable to Putin. Russia keeps all the territory it's taking, as well as Crimea. What does that mean for Ukraine? What does it mean for NATO? What does it mean for Putin?
Well, it means a lot for each one, but I would be a little careful, Al. If Trump pressures Kyiv to give away territory and humiliates our European allies in the process, he's going to look weak. And that's not where Trump likes to be. If Putin walks away with a clear victory, it's going to look bad for Trump. So Trump's a deal maker. He's going to have to think about how to get a deal. And that means having some common ground with our European allies of taking into account the extraordinary sacrifices of the Ukrainian people. So I don't think it's a snap judgment of just stepping on the stage and looking at Vladimir Putin and saying, let's make a deal. It's got to be much more carefully designed, or we will look to be the loser.
Yeah, Frank, but as you know better than almost anyone, to make a deal, you have to have deal makers. You have to have people who are versed, people who know how to do that. I'm not sure there's anyone around Trump that really fits that bill.
I don't see one coming immediately to the fore, and I'm not sure Trump has thought this through as to who he would have as his lead negotiator to sit down with the Russians and cobble together a coalition of those who would join us finding a way forward, including with Kyiv. I don't see one yet, but I wouldn't throw my hands up in despair.
James.
Ambassador, in a diplomatic language, you said you find Trump's picks to be uninspiring. In political language, I find him to be a pack of criminal buffoons. So I'm not going to ask you to endorse that, because that's not a very diplomatic word. But I do want to explore something. As I understand it, your dad was one of the founders of the CIA. You were four times ambassador for a brief period of time, but you were Secretary of State. Albert told me that your son is in the Foreign Service, is now ambassador to Albania. Foreign Service exam is not anything to sneeze at. But by any definition, your family is part of the establishment. Okay, there's just no other way to, and I don't know what it, I don't necessarily know that that's a bad thing. I mean, we hadn't been in a major war since 1945. We've had a lot of screw-ups, but, you know, we still were a dominant nation. What do you think caused people to be so, and 4% unemployment, hardly any American being killed in any conflict abroad? I mean, if you just look at the fall of 2024 and your magnificent long view of history, how did we end up here in a time of 4% unemployment? No, very few, I can't tell you somebody didn't get killed somewhere, but very, very few combat casualties, disastrous foreign deployments, anything like that. What's going to happen to our country when it inevitably hit 7.5% unemployment? I mean, what brought us here? How did we get here? What did you guys do?
Good question. James, first of all, the present elected president, Donald Trump, didn't get elected on foreign policy. This was an election that was lost to the Democrats on domestic issues, and foreign policy played a significant role in the outcome. America's in pretty good shape around the world, respected. There is no peer power to compete with us. We're in pretty good shape. So that isn't what brought us to this point. Can we be unseated given poor governance? We certainly can. And I worry enormously that the current the current direction we're taking is going to weaken the United States, divide us internally, and weaken us in the eyes of our allies, and weaken us in the eyes of those who would see America displaced as the leading power on the global stage.
So, Ambassador, you know, I'm a veteran of the Vietnam era. I didn't serve in Vietnam, but I'm a Vietnam era vet. I was a young man during that. I read the best and the brightest. I think the establishment profoundly let us down. Okay, I will say that. I think most people would, like, agree with me.
I'm not going to disagree.
Right. I don't think that there was a you know, like anybody else, people make mistakes. We have, you know, obviously the Iraq War was a giant mistake. Afghanistan was a giant mistake. But we didn't have anything on that colossal nature. And are we going to be able to continue? What's the outlook going forward of having a professional diplomatic class? I've traveled around the world, been invited to embassy. I've met foreign service officers. I know what it takes to be that. It's not easy. The Foreign Service exam is not, you can't fall off the turnip truck and pass that goddamn thing. I can tell you that right now. It is not, these are professional people. We'll assume that this is a 4-year hiatus. Are we still good? What's the future of a class of professional, highly trained, apolitical diplomatic corps?
You ask a very good question, James. I can't deny that. I worry for the future of our professional diplomats, but and I can speak with firsthand knowledge, we have darn good people in the field today. We have darn good people serving in Washington. We attract some of the best in this country, and in the course of my lifetime, we've left the Harvard, Princeton, Yales, and have reached out into all corners of this nation to acquire top quality people. I think we've got a first-rate diplomatic corps, and if provided, of course, that between Mr. Trump and Mr. Rubio, we don't undermine it, it will be the basis of a legacy in the future. But I go back to a point you made about Vietnam. And yes, I have to agree with you. I served nearly 10 years of my life in Vietnam, so I knew it firsthand. But I'm reminded when I look back that we are wrong to think that the conditions that we experience today were the conditions we felt in the late 50s, early 60s when we became involved in Vietnam. In those days, we believed the United States was a beleaguered nation. We were beset by the Soviet Union and its allies and the spread of communist power throughout Asia as well as Europe was a direct, imminent threat to the United States and had to be opposed. Were we correct? No, we were not. But that was the national assumption, and it was held deeply on Capitol Hill, in the press, academic circles. That changed. But I do ask that when you look at history, you judge it on the terms that it experienced at the time it was being lived, as opposed to look back and pass judgment.
Well, I'm going to leave it at, I think you're very generous to these people. My knowledge of history is Ho Chi Minh was a Vietnamese nationalist. And we took it to mean that, you know, he wanted a unified country, and the communists gave him help, so he became a communist. But I understand, and I understand, like, good people got caught up in it, but we're going to just agree to disagree. I think it was less understandable and just monumental error. But that'll be my view.
In retrospect, Jim, you're absolutely right. I have no question of everything you said about Ho Chi Minh and about the Vietnamese communist movement the mixture of nationalism and national liberation. All of this is painfully obvious in retrospect. I was making a slightly different point.
I understand. Okay, before I turn it over, I'll just make a point. The people that were there were highly trained. They were supposed to know more than us. I was a lance corporal, okay? Robert McNamara and George Bundy, whoever these people were, they were supposed to know more than me, okay? And that's my. But I don't want to refight that war for sure.
I
appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Let me talk about other great challenges with the new administration coming in. Frank, you know that we are the world's superpower. We certainly are. The closest rival is China. One thing Biden did do, which I think he didn't get much credit for, he did stitch together, you know, a Pacific alliance. A lot of countries that, you know, didn't want to be at least recognize the presence of China. Trump doesn't have much interest in alliance. His approach will be tough tariffs. Will that make a difference?
Now let's take ourselves back to the Trump period and remember that the birth of the Japan, Australia, India, U.S. Lash-up began during Trump. Joe Biden took it, matured it, and made it a major arm of dealing with Chinese power and of projecting American influence. However, begin under Trump. There is the record of the first Trump administration has, you can point to serious examples of working with allies around the world. Unfortunately, the public persona of the administration is that America will go on its own. And that persona has affected the image of the United States worldwide. And it is a serious problem for this administration as it comes to office. The U.S. cannot survive alone in the world. We can't just create chaos, stomp our foot, and have our way. We have to do it realistically. We have to do it with other nations, rising nations like China, and established allies like our European and Asian friends. So reality may not be the first impulse of the new administration, but we'll get there. We can't survive otherwise.
Well, let me turn to an area that you know so well. You know all areas well, but the Middle East. My view is that Bibi played Trump, or played Biden, that, you know, he really did. And we paid for it, and that your friend, the late Martin Indyk's dream of a two-state solution is probably dead now. But then Tom Friedman writes in the New York Times that this is the great opportunity for Trump. How do you see it?
Well, it's Friedman's Times is tantalizing because it offers two options. It offers a sort of U.S.-Israel-only policy for the Middle East with Mike Huckabee sitting in Jerusalem. But it reminds us that it was under Trump in the latter days of the Trump administration, under the impulse of Kushner, that we actually put a two-state solution on the table. And Tom offers the intriguing thought that Trump's got a choice to make. He can go a Huckabee route or he can go back to a Kushner route. We'll have to see. I'll bet you push Trump today, he can't tell you exactly which road he'll travel. If he travels the road of the late 2020, came up with the plan, the basis of a plan for a two-state solution, we could make something of that. Tom Friedman's absolutely right. So I'd like to think that Trump is going to look back over his shoulder and say, it wasn't so bad where I left off. let me resume there.
Frank, few people know the Iranians, dealt with them more than you have. What do you think their view is right now, and how do you see this unfolding? Both, will it be more contentious? Will they have a nuclear weapon soon? I mean, what's going to happen?
Well, it's going to be contentious. We in Iran have been at loggerheads since 1979, so that ain't going to go away. But the issue is whether we can manage contention and avoid getting ourselves embroiled in violence, in a war with the Iranians. In my judgment, based on what I know, the Iranians did not want a war. They did not want the current fighting in Gaza. They didn't want Hezbollah to be thrown into combat with Israel. They wanted Hezbollah to be a deterrent, to act as a defense shield for Iran. Furthermore, when I came back to Washington in the early 90s, I was told within a matter of months, Iran would have a nuclear weapon. That's the early 90s. They are nowhere near having one even today. And that's the conclusion over the decades of the American Intelligence Service, virtually every observer I know. The Iranians see a nuclear capability as a deterrent possibility without being a reality, which would only increase danger. Therefore, I believe they've got their hands full today. Their alliance with Hezbollah, with Hamas, with the Houthis in Yemen, come up short. The Israelis have put paid to it. Their external defenses are weak. Ayatollah is in his very advanced dotage, and how long he'll be around, the Iranians are going to face a transition to a new leadership. Their economy is in shambles. They are in a weakened position, and they do not historically like to be stuck as an ally with only China and Russia. They want maneuverability on the world stage. Therefore, I think there is an opportunity for American diplomacy to avoid a conflict and find a modus vivendi with Iran. And I don't rule out that possibility. The signals that you're seeing already from the Iranians that they want to communicate with this administration are palpable, and I hope that they're picked up in Washington and acted on, and we set aside our sort of phobia about Iran. There's no reason to have phobias. We got to deal with reality.
James Carville, final question.
So, Ambassador, I'm going to do something that I shouldn't do. I'm going to ask you about something that I'm interested in, but I doubt that our listeners are. But I grew up with a sort of traditional view of Japan in World War II, that it was just a sneak thing and we were just innocent people. Actually, we were not just innocent people. We did not respect Japan. We made some mistakes, okay? I didn't realize that until I got older and started reading about it. And
yes.
What I wonder is the country that like sticks to me, and you know maybe one of the three most knowledgeable people in the United States about this, I don't know if we respect India enough. I mean, that is a really accomplished, to say the least. It's not just populous, okay? I mean, they have real culture. They have real achievement. And I somehow or another, you hear a lot about China, you hear a lot about Russia, you hear a lot about Iran, you hear a lot about Israel, you hear a lot about Saudi Arabia, you hear a lot about Brazil, you know, Japan and Australia and that thing. But what do you see India's role going forward, and where do you see the United States and India? I mean, they're a pretty big deal. I mean, they're going to be in the pretty sure they, you know, they stick out in the Indian Ocean. You know, they're pretty good. They seem to me, if you just look at the map, and goddamn, this thing looked kind of important.
You know, it's the most populous nation in the world, and in a decade or so, it's going to be the third largest economy. Don't treat India lightly. I certainly don't. We were at loggerheads with the Indians from the late 50s until the early 1990s. One of the great privileges of my life, serving at a time in which our relationship with India turned around and we began to find common ground with India in commercial affairs and technology, the movement of people, and in geopolitical outlook. Today, we have a strong relationship with India, and it's based on a core fact, Jim. That core fact is called China. India sees China as a major threat. We do the same. India realizes it can't face China without us, and vice versa. We can't deal with China without allies. India is number one. Started in the Trump administration, the creation of the India, U.S., Australia deal, where we all began to come together to send a signal to China. So I think we're going to go forward and we're going to grow this relationship from the present strong positions in to an even stronger one because it's in our mutual interests. But I enter one thought for you to keep in mind, James, and that is India is India. It's an ancient country, ancient civilization. It has its own impulses. It will act in its own self-interest. It seeks strategic autonomy. It will not be America's poodle. It will be a considered associate with us in that part of the world. So we need to respect India's independent identity and find common ground as opposed to assuming that India will follow in our footsteps.
Thank you, Yaxin Singh. Thank you so much, sir. It was a real honor to talk to you and explore some of these. I hope we can get with Albert and go to dinner one night in Washington, and I could just sit at your feet and ask you all the other questions about history and diplomacy that kind of burst out when you get retired and you read too many books and watch too many documentaries. But thank you so much, Ambassador.
Well, yeah, I want to join in thanking you, and I want to say you can see, James, now why he is my favorite former Secretary of State.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And now for the outrage of the week. When South Carolina's Nancy Mace came to Congress 4 years ago, I really thought she would be an interesting member. She was the first woman graduate of the Citadel, seemingly smart, quick. What a disappointment. She is a fraud. Her former staff, by the way, she has one of the highest turnovers in the House, which is always an indicator, say that she's more interested in publicity, getting attention, than in legislating or getting things done. She is a classic show horse in contrast to the workhorses. She showed this anew this week when she proposed legislation to deny certain bathroom privileges to any trans members. That's aimed at only the newly elected representative from Delaware, Sarah McBride. It's just cheap demagoguery, which has unfortunately become a trademark of Nancy Mace. I think there are legitimate questions about, for instance, trans women playing in certain sports, as our guest Martina Navratilova told us a couple months ago, but the bathroom issue is not one of them. Sarah McBride, as a new member, deserves respect, and that's something that Nancy Mace is oblivious to.
I keep coming back. Before the pandemic, I went to Amsterdam, the airport. They don't have men's room or women's room. They just have stalls. Why don't we just go to that? It's not that big a deal. It's such a fucking dumb, aggravating thing.
You know, they tried it in North Carolina, and they were going to do it, and suddenly, guess what? When the UNC and the Duke basketball coaches waited and said, we ain't going to play in North Carolina, they quickly changed.
That's just insane. I first of all, would point out our friend Walter Pincus, who at advanced age continues to just amaze with stories. Of course, we couldn't say it because the public doesn't believe it, but actually crime in the United States is down, and it's down significantly. One thing that we were conditioned to believe, and actually I believe it, that's why you can't trust what you get. That's why you can't trust. That military recruitment was down. You know, they said no one wanted to join the woke military. I said, well, it's down, and that's a function of a good economy. I mean, it's the way you politically look at something. So military recruitment is down. It's because of the woke military. No, it's because the Biden's economy is so good, no one wants to serve in the military. Actually, they're both wrong. Military recruitment is hot as hell. They're exceeding their quotas right now. If you didn't read the cipher brief, which Walter writes at, or more importantly, if you didn't watch his show, you would not know that. And we have, unfortunately, and I don't know why, I don't know if it's we don't communicate information or people don't listen to information. I suspect our friend Michael Tomansky is right. We're all so subjected to white right-wing propaganda that we even believe it.
Right.
Okay, we even believe
James,
the bullshit.
You're right. They put out this story. We say there must be something to it.
Right. I don't read what you'd call a counterfactual. I just assumed because of low unemployment and job opportunities in the private sector that I've always thought, and I think there's some correlation to it historically, between, you know, if you want to get, good soldiers have a shitty economy and you can get three hots in a cot. That's not the case now. I think we don't appreciate the country that we live in, and I think to some extent that's a kind of indictment on everybody in a way. But when I read that story, I'm like, shit, I didn't know this. And I talk to you, I pride myself, if you watch a documentary, which people are complimenting me all the time, I have multiple conversations every day, mostly political people, but I think mostly well-read, informed people. And none of us fucking knew this. And that's the outrage, that we're just making decisions. And it's not just the Trump people. It's not just the people that watch, Mark Levin that are thinking this. We thought that. We did. And that's a problem. It really is. And I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I don't know what the overall answer is, too. But you certainly cited one of the important answers, and that is Walter Pincus. He has been a national treasure for decades and decades. And you're absolutely right. Anyone who hasn't read his Cipher Brief column today ought to read it, because he demonstrated, totally that the defense secretary designate is full of shit, if you'll pardon the expression. He has no idea what he's talking about. So here's to Walter Pincus, James.
Absolutely. But that is one of those most illuminating things I've read this year. It really was. It shattered my own fucking belief. Yep. Hey, Walter, you and Ann, best of luck to you.
And now for the listener questions. James, it's not surprising our listeners aren't exactly upbeat these days, but as always, they ask some great questions. Michelle in McAlpin, Florida, wants you to tell her, how can we make the DNC more effective?
Wow. I don't know. I'm told at the front runner, I don't know this, I'm not into DNC politics, I've never been to a DNC meeting in my entire life, that Ken Martin, who's the chair of the DFL in Minnesota, who is highly respected, is a semi-front runner for this. I hope whoever it is reimagines what the DNC could be, because right now it's just a giant waste of everything you can imagine. And of course, they're having terrible morale problems because they're laying people off. Of course, they unionize, which is fast right now. And I think, so I actually think the DNC long-term employees should be unionized. I'm less enthusiastic about unionizing campaigns, although that seems to be the trend, because campaigns are pop-up restaurants. But I don't want to get into that argument, but there's a lot of stories about lack of morale, a lot of stories about spending that took place. I mean, it's definitely time to turn a page there. I don't know which way that we're going to turn the page, backwards or forwards, or
I don't know if it matters either. James, and I don't know Mr. Martin, you may be quite good. If I were to pick someone who's just a great political organizer, I would look to Ben Wickler in Wisconsin if he wants it. And if you want, just someone out front, a fascinating choice would be our old friend Mallory McMurrow from Michigan, who's expressed some interest. But it's a question of what do you want it to be?
Martin O'Malley is running for it.
We know what we don't want it to be, which is what it has been. John in Gurnee, Illinois says, how much blame do you give to Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries for the across-the-board election losses, and who would you like to see take their positions? I give them very little blame, and I would like to see Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries continue as leaders. I think given their positions, it was very hard for them to push Biden out earlier. I wish some others had done that. But I think given a difficult hand, Schumer and Jeffries are the best people to lead the Senate and the House.
Well, I agree they should stay in their jobs, all right? But I do think that this was a kind of total party failure. I really do. I would blame myself somewhat. But if you start assessing blame, 90% of the blame goes to Joe Biden. Okay, and you can say, well, it was Schumer, Jeffries could have done better, or Jamie Harrison at the DNC, or something like this. When this bell is unrung, there's one person that's going to be held accountable for this, and that person is Joe Biden, who people like justifiably, people respect, people think is it's ultimate tragic figure about maybe of my lifetime. But to blame anything but him is to miss the point. The two albatrosses that we had was the hangover from the identity politics of the early part of this decade, and that people wanted something different than Biden, and we picked the daily double, and no one could do anything.
On Biden, I think, there's no question of that. This is a sequel to that, I suppose. Simon in Cincinnati, Ohio, James, wants to know, who will history view worse? Merrick Garland for failing to adequately investigate and indict Trump soon enough, or the viable presidential candidates who didn't primary Biden?
I think it's Biden, 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 Biden. Then you can, after that, you can sort of assess blame. Democrats tend to be respectful of people like Joe Biden. You got to understand that. People didn't want to do it. They just thought it was too much trouble. People in the party like him. He's a very likable person. He's built relationships. To talk about somebody should have primaried him or talk about Merrick Garland is to miss the overwhelming point. I think that Merrick Garland is going to go down as a man so respectful of tradition and so respectful of institutions that he was really kind of strange to say this about a guy that was an appellate court judge, experienced and highly trained attorney. He was naive. He was trying to play by one set of rules, and everybody's playing by another set of rules. And yeah. I don't think he's a bad guy. I think at the end of the day, he's just a horribly naive man that had no idea what he was up against.
Yeah, that's for sure. Julie in Farmington Valley, Connecticut says, is it a good idea to gift friends and families news subscriptions this Christmas as gifts to keep people more engaged? And what should we give them? Well, yeah, fine, Julie. I think you should give them, you know, tell them about Politicon. Tell them about Politics War Room. That's what, you know, you can get it both in Substack and watch this podcast and our sponsor, The Washington Post. I think that's a great idea. And have them. James, I went and I wish you a happy birthday a month ago. So today I better wish my wife a happy birthday. Her birthday is the same birthday as Joe Biden and Robert Kennedy, the real Robert F. Kennedy. But so you can also look at her American at a Crossroads series on PBS. But yeah, give people things to read.
You know, matey, so you look back in your life and things that really made a difference. And when I tell you that I grew up in deep rural South Louisiana, when you watch the movie, you'll see just how deep and how rural South Louisiana I grew up. Very impoverished place. And one of the things is a young boy, and I mean really young boy, like second grade, my grandmother would give me for Christmas a subscription to the National Geographic. I cannot tell you what a profound effect that had on my life. My entire reference point was Baton Rouge. Maybe once a year for something, you'd go to New Orleans, but it's kind of an exotic place. You know, first time I probably went beyond Louisiana, Mississippi was when I joined the Marine Corps and I was in my 20s. But I cannot tell you what vistas that subscription opened to me. And she was very kind of proud that she got that subscription to me. Because I think, you know, that there are things now when you give somebody, but what I would do is I would give young people subscriptions to really good journalism. I don't want to sit here and, you know, the Washington Post is sponsored ours. You certainly couldn't go wrong giving somebody, I mean this sincerely, you never go wrong giving somebody a Washington Post subscription.
But, well, I just gave my just about to be 7-year-old grandson, happy birthday next week, Kai. I just gave him all the old National Geographics we have, which our kids had had and I had filed. And he is going to he's going to get so much out of just, you know, browsing through those.
Oh, God.
So, you know, he's trying to follow you, James.
Well, good.
Ward in South Carolina says, James, I just saw you in Robert Crawford's film, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Anything about your experience?
Well, one of the things that happened in there is if I play myself, I'm fine. What I came to learn in that, I had to try to play somebody else, and I wasn't very good at it. Acting is a very difficult profession. And, you know, we see these great, you know, performers, be actors, actresses, or whatever it is. And if you ever try it one day, it's really, really a craft. And that's what I learned. I have so much respect for people who have, you know, multifaceted, can do film, can do Broadway, can do TV, can sing, can do everything. We take people's talent for granted. And boy, let me tell you, that's real, real freaking talent they have. You know, we tend to honor a kind of athletic talent or intellectual talent or ability to make money or anything. I would put actors and actresses at the very top of a really, really talented and remarkably difficult craft. That's
James,
what I learned.
Our final question, which probably calls for a short answer. Madeline in Greenville, North Carolina. Why do so many Democrats like Biden and RBG wait until it's way too late to get out?
You know, I don't know if it's a Democratic problem. People very rarely, I mean, almost never, let go of power. That's why they had to put the two-term amendment. All right? The examples of people voluntarily, you know, relinquishing power to do something else, a few and far between, and they should always be honored. One of my favorite stories in history is de Gaulle, when he was older, said he wasn't going to run again. And they went crazy, and they said, Monsieur, what's France going to do with that, without you? And he looked up and he said, you know, the graveyards are full of indispensable people. And as depressing as that thought is, it is the principal lesson of history. And, you know, as they say, there's no one deader than a dead pope. Okay, remember that.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Well, sadly, we were taught that this year. But listen, keep those. If we didn't get to your question this week, we'll try to get to it next week because, boy, they are good. Thank you.
So that last question might be the best one we ever got.
Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Quince, Miracle Made, and The Washington Post in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I constantly are adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.